What up? It's the Full 48, powered back senior NBA writer for Bleacher Report. That is the 247th time I have said that introduction, and it is unfortunately the last. Yes, this is the final episode of the Full 48. I will be departing Bleacher Report soon, so this podcast, the Full 48, is done, kaput. I don't know what's going to be on this feed after this episode, if anything, but it won't be me. Can't thank you all enough for your support, your listenership these last few years, and I will have another podcast before too long, and I would love for you to follow me there and subscribe there. I don't have those details today, so what I need you to do, listeners, do me a favor, hit pause and go to howardbeck.com. I know, clever name, howardbeck.com. It's simple. You just go there, enter your email address. That will give me a nice mailing list. I will personally email you when my new podcast and all my new ventures are ready to launch. So go to howardbeck.com, enter your email address. And you can, of course, also follow me on Twitter at Howard Beck. I will announce whatever news I have there. I couldn't think of a better way to end this podcast than to bring back my good friends Zach Lowe and Rachel Nichols from ESPN. Wrap up the finals, this weird-ass bubble season, all of that. But before we get to that discussion, please hang with me a minute or two here, listeners. There are a bunch of folks I want to thank, and they deserve your appreciation, too. I just want to run through that real quick. Jordan Brenner, my co-host for this podcast when we launched in April 2017. Jordan's also the one who came up with the name The Full 48. Yeah, that was his idea. And he was a driving force in getting this thing off the ground back in 2017. So thank you, Jordan. Thank you to Bleacher Report's founder, Dave Finocchio, for being incredibly supportive of this pod and all of my work for BR the last 7 years. Thanks to former BR execs Rory Brown and Howard Mittman, who believed in this show and, again, very supportive of me and my work the last 7 years. Thank you to all the engineers and production folks who have worked on this, Mark Steinmetz, Alan Labiner, Matt O'Connor. Special shout out to my boy, Nicolas Giangrande, not only for his technical support, but his moral support, his friendship. The bird is the word, Nick. I'm going to miss you, buddy. Thanks to Commissioner Adam Silver, who was the very first guest on this podcast back in April 2017, made a repeat return or two along the way. Thank you to the dozens of other guests who have made the show such a blast. Way too many to name, of course, but GMs and coaches and players and my media pals, everybody. I'm going to be hitting you all up again as soon as I get the next podcast going. And finally, a huge, massive, heartfelt thank you and eternal gratitude to my producer these last few years, Stacey Parra, who has had the thankless task of listening to hours and hours of my rambling and then making me and this podcast sound great. People sometimes ask about how to do this, about podcasting. I say, I don't know. I have the easy part. I just book the guests, hit record, and do the interviews. And then Stacey does all the magic that actually puts this thing out in the world and makes it sound great and answers all my annoying technical questions. So Stacey, you've been absolutely essential, a great partner in this show. I'm going to miss working with you. Thank you for everything. And again, listeners, thank you. Grateful for all your support, your feedback, all the nice notes on Apple Podcasts, on Twitter. You've made this show a blast. It will continue elsewhere, I promise. Follow me on Twitter at Howard Beck. Go to howardbeck.com. Enter your email address. You'll be the first to know the details of what's next. And okay, here we go. The last ever Full 48 with my pals Zach and Rach coming up now. Okay, it's the end of the Full 48 as we know it. And I feel fine. Apologies to my favorite band. I feel better knowing that I'm spending this last episode with my good pals from ESPN, Zach Lowe and Rachel Nichols. Rach, Zach, great to see your faces. Rach, great job last night. Thank you for attending this wake for the Full 48.
I'm honored. I'm sad. I'm excited for what's next. But I feel that we need to pay proper respect. So I'm here for that.
I appreciate that. And the day after also, by the way, a huge moment. So I want to just start right here because, first of all, we're taping on Monday afternoon. Congrats to the Lakers, obviously, LeBron and AD, Jeannie Buss, Rob Pelinka. Congrats, Adam Silver and the NBA for pulling us all off. And Rach, congrats to you. That was so cool. No, there was, listen, that is a huge assignment, an important assignment. And you got to do the trophy presentation in the bubble, the most unique trophy presentation we will ever see. So I just want to start there, actually. As the only one of the three of us who was there, and not to mention on the floor, presiding over these proceedings, like, what was the coolest thing you saw or heard?
Well, definitely just that feeling of, wait, is this happening? Because you guys know, I come from newspaper land, right? Not someone who should have been ever doing something like that. And going into the bubble, there were all sorts of different jobs ESPN wanted us to do, and I was unsure about some of them and more sure about others of them. But I knew the one thing that made me most excited was this trophy presentation, the final 5 minutes of the 3 months, because it just seemed sort of like this thing that I could have never imagined when I started at Northwestern as a college newspaper stringer, covering the 90s Bulls, and never really thought that that was something I would get to do. So just even having that sort of experience in the moment felt surreal in the moment. And I was super nervous, and I had to look down at a piece of paper to make sure that I correctly identified the Larry O'Brien Trophy when introducing Adam Silver, because, you know, I've only seen and talked about it thousands of times. But the joy up there was what kind of I'd always felt like it was, watching those moments and to kind of be in the middle of it. And I was really thrilled to see that the fact that we were in a bubble and there wasn't a full arena full of fans didn't really change the level of joy for the people participating. All that work they did, it's still as real as it would have been in front of 20,000 people. And it still felt just as good to them to have it pay off the way it did. And that felt really cool to be a part of.
I got to say, it did. Like, there were multiple times last night where it just felt like Frank Vogel was trying to do that, I'm so proud of this team, we're world champs. And like, it just like dissipated into the air, right? Like, if that were at Staples Center, or even if it had been, you know, in Miami, like, the any moment like that, there's a buzz and there's a reaction. And it was just like, he's yelling this to like the 20 people who are not on screen that we can't see, right? Like family members and stuff. I don't know. It was just weird. I was glad to see that they allowed, you got to be unmasked. Jeannie got to be on the court and without a mask. At the end of the bubble, they got to break protocols. Zach, what struck you watching it all unfold last night?
First of all, Rachel, I need to clarify something real fast. Did you have a piece of paper with a photo of the Larry O'Brien Trophy, and like it said, this is the Larry O'Brien Trophy? Like, I need further understanding of what that was.
So the NBA, this is not going to shock you, the NBA gives you a very strict script of not the Q&As with the different people coming up, but just of the sort of beats of the presentation, right? And the things that you have to get right are how you introduce the commissioner and how you reintroduce the commissioner for the Bill Russell MVP. And it is not the MVP, of course, it is the Bill Russell MVP. And how you introduce the commissioner, how I introduced Jeannie Buss, all of that was sort of strict. So I had this moment where I did not want to get the two or three things I was supposed to do up there wrong, and had to look down, and I did, which was embarrassing because I was like, yes, this is the Larry O'Brien Trophy, that is Adam Silver, but you want to get the words exactly like they want you to have those 12 words. They want them in the right order, and there you go.
Now that's clarified, what struck me, Mr. Beck, and I want to also say I am mourning the end of this podcast and excited for whatever is coming next, as Rachel said, and honored to be a guest. Just sad that I'm not drinking, because we should be drinking, but I have to go on The Jump, which is hosted by Rachel Nichols, in about an hour and a half. And if I start drinking before live national television, it's going to be the end. It's just the end.
I think it'd be great for the rest of us. It would be a blast just to watch you.
I was going
to
say, as the host of said television, one thing they don't
talk about, one thing they don't talk about enough about LeBron. let me tell you something. I love a good finals clincher. I become a hugger after the finals. And I know that we're supposed to remain objective. And, you know, there's no cheering in the press box. Obviously, I'm not cheering. I don't care who wins. I don't care what the result is. But I let my guard down and I hug and high-five the people that I know, regardless of which team wins, because I just know how this is their life. I know how much work they've put into it. And I like to see them get rewarded at the get the ultimate reward at the end of the day. But one of my favorite, most fond memories of this job is when I saw Marc Gasol come out of the arena or come off the floor last season. And Mark and I have known each other a long time, and I wasn't really expecting more than an elbow bump or something. And he came and bear hugged me so hard that I thought my teeth were going to fall out of my face. And I love those moments. So I was struck by even watching the Laker fans celebrate all the videos of them without masks and stuff, which is a little scary. But I love that too. Like, I remember driving back from San Antonio with Kevin Arnovitz. We couldn't even get back to our hotel because every street was blocked by crazy fans. People were hanging out of cars going like 60 miles an hour. Like, I just, of all the pieces of normalcy that we don't get to have right now, I found myself longing for those.
Yeah. The joy is what matters, right? Like, that's why we do this. That's why the players play and the coaches coach, and it's why fans root. And, you know, sometimes it gets lost amid all of all of our silly debates and everything else. And in a year like this, a season like this, where we've all just seen and been through the most bizarre circumstances, to see that at the end, like that endures. The joy endures. And in absence of 20,000 screaming fans, during post-game stuff, you were hearing, and especially, like, I was watching some of the NBA TV, like, kids are on the court, like, frolicking in the confetti. So that was kind of neat, because it became more intimate. It was about their families and their kids being there, and those reunions, as well as the championship itself.
I love those two little girls, right? That was Anthony Davis's daughter and Markieff Morris's daughter, and they were behind us during some of the trophy and some of the post-game presentations. And they were the best. They were so sweet. It was great.
LeBron said something to you, Rach, immediately after, as he's answering all these questions. And he's talking about everybody who needs their respect, and Pelinka and everybody. And then he said, "And I want my damn respect too." And I'm curious what both of you think, not what it means. I think we know what that means. But where was it coming from? That he's won three titles prior to this. He's won four regular season MVPs and three finals MVPs prior to this. He was already in the debate for greatest of all time. I want my damn respect too. Where was that coming from?
Well, I asked him after, because I sat down with LeBron and Anthony Davis, which is available on the internet by the time you listen to this podcast, since it will be also on Today's Jump. And, you know, in his LeBron way, and we've learned this, anytime you ask him a question about legacy or where he fits with Jordan or where he fits in a bigger NBA picture, his stock answer is, "I bet you guys could do it, right?" It's, "Well, that's for you guys to debate and discuss, and I'll do it when I'm sitting with a glass of wine when I'm older," and all of that stuff, right? But he got into a little bit about how he plays the game, and that's what he wants the respect for. That whether you add up his numbers or his titles, and the numbers, by the way, are insane when you look at them, the way he goes about playing basketball is something that is so important to him, and that he wants people to respect the fact that in his eyes, he honors the game and the way it should be played. And I do find that super interesting, because the way he plays basketball is sort of the discussion that LeBron emerged into superstardom in this league with, right? I mean, it was like the topic of conversation for a long time when he was sort of really coming to the fore of being the guy in the NBA. And to have that be the thing in his 17th year that he is most focused on is kind of interesting, right?
Well, I think David Aldridge made this point in his piece today for The Athletic. You know, LeBron doesn't want to have those, you know, "Oh, that's for you guys, all the Jordan stuff." But, you know, he gave an interview to Lee Jenkins after, I think, the Cleveland title, the 2016 title, I think. Current Clippers front office employee Lee Jenkins. How wild is
yes.
that?
Yes.
About how he's chasing ghosts and the ghost wears number 23. So, like, we did not just create this idea that LeBron cares about his standing relative to Michael Jordan. He spoke it out loud. I wonder if he actually regrets saying that out loud, but he spoke it out loud. And it turns out.
I did ask him about that last night, Zach.
What did he say? I can't. Well, I'm going to hear it. I haven't heard it yet, but I'm going to hear it on the
show. No. But just that I think he does. I don't know if he regrets it, but he definitely sloughed it off pretty quickly. So, to your point.
But, you know, I wrote a piece a couple weeks ago now about the Lakers defense, which to me was their bedrock all season long, and about how LeBron, after, I mean, I can say this impolitely, kind of biding his time to try really hard on defense in Cleveland for the most part. I mean, understandably, LeBron is now third all time in minutes played. Like, he can't go full throttle all the time. And why he did not do that this year, why day one preseason training camp, he's flying around like 2013 LeBron in Miami, a less athletic and older version of that. And I talked to a lot of people around LeBron about it. You know, why now? And I had theories. And Rich Paul talked to me on the record and said, essentially, LeBron heard all the noise about how he may not be the best player in the NBA anymore. And more than that, he had a sense that he was almost suffering his version of the James Harden YouTube thing, where people will highlight like James Harden falling asleep on defense 10 times in a season and splice it up and make it a clip. And I think he felt like that was starting to happen to him. Specifically, the defense was why he was being, well, maybe Kawhi's the guy now, or Giannis is the guy. And that's what Rich told me was one of the motivating factors, which I thought was really interesting.
Well, that, and I have to believe that some piece of it too, is that, you know, even though LeBron is superhuman and possibly not of this earth, he is turning 36 in December, which normally that would be like we'd be saying, oh, yeah, and then later this year. No. Actually, we've finished the finals and December is now 2 months away, which is weird. LeBron's turning 36 soon. Like he may not be hearing a clock ticking, but he has to know there's a sunset somewhere out there on the horizon. And, you know, there's no time like the present, and he's got Anthony Davis. And yeah, if there's ever a time to go all out from 1 through 82 or 67 or whatever they played, like this was the time to do it, because as he well knows, especially after last season's injury, nothing's guaranteed. You don't know what your window is. And like he had to grab it now, because, and he knows this as well as anybody, and you guys know this too, every single one of these opportunities might be the last one. Every single one of them involves some good fortune. And like, no matter how stacked your team is, no matter what the landscape looks like, you just don't know what's coming next. You might have a global pandemic that shuts down a season for 4 months.
Well, the injury is interesting though, right? Because it did give him something he hadn't had in a decade, which is time, right? It gave him a tremendous amount of time and rest, and his body rest. And then frankly, the pandemic shutdown gave him another 3 or 4 month break before the last kick of the playoffs. So I think he saw the opportunity, and he's smart enough to know, and got, you know, we know that he knows and invests in his body in a way no player ever has before. So knowing that he had that rest going into this season, I'm sure was a factor, and knowing that he'd have this kick that he probably hoped he wouldn't have again, because he hoped he'd be playing through June again, turned out to be October. I do think that injury too opened his eyes a little bit. You know, all athletes, especially the super, super, superstars, think that they have a dose of immortality, right? I mean, their body has literally never let them down since they were teenagers. They have been real life superheroes. They have been able to jump higher, run faster than any of the rest of us. And all of a sudden, he became human for a little bit. So I'm sure then, like with anybody, when you experience something like that and you come back the next time, you appreciate it more and know that what might be coming down the road might be coming for you sooner than you thought.
I've said several times, guys, and I don't think this is a hot take by any stretch. Like, he could have retired 3-4 years ago and his legacy was already set, right? Like, after the 2016 title, he's got his 3 rings. He's got his MVPs. He's way up there on the charts and all the record books. Like, there's nothing he had to really left to prove. And he said it himself. Among the other things he has said that he kind of has backed away from now was, I have nothing left to prove. And I think it was McManaman who might have thrown that one back to him last night when he kind of batted it away. He didn't. I mean, it's in a lot of ways, he didn't. The fact that he said last night then, thinking I have something to prove fuels me, and that there's still these rumblings of doubt, I think he said. I love the fact that at this age, he has all the wealth, all of the fame, all the accomplishments in the world. I just think it is inspiring that he still finds that there's more for him to do, to accomplish, to prove. In concert with that, the longer he's in, and the fact that he's still playing this year when he could have, as I say, in a hypothetical universe, could have retired a couple years ago, would have been fine. He's stuck around long enough to make the impact he's making off the court with regard to social justice, as well as all the other things he does, and voter suppression, and like, he's doing this at a high enough level still that he is proving once again what he means to the game. And he's using that platform more than he ever has. And there's an importance to that that I just think shouldn't get lost amid all of our returning to MJ versus LeBron for the GOAT discussions and all that.
Well, I mean, look, I'm leaving all that stuff aside, because I always tell people, like, the dude built a school. Like, I can't even, like, I don't even know how to conceptualize that. I can't build a birdhouse. He built a school, okay? Like, it's ridiculous. But when you say his legacy would have been okay if he had retired in 2016, it depends what you're okay with. Because if he retires in 2016, he is not and never will be the greatest player of all time. And I have to believe, I've never talked to LeBron about it. I would almost be afraid to ask the question directly. But on some level, I would have to believe he cares about being the greatest player of all time. He cares about how he stands up against Michael Jordan. I mean, he said does. It himself. And if you retire with three titles and, you know, whatever you're right. I mean, I guess at that point he was 3-4 in the finals and then they lose the next two. He would have forfeited a chance to be the all-time leading scorer in the NBA, which he's on track to be. And the cumulative stats are going to be a huge part of his argument. I just have to believe on some level he cares about that.
What athlete doesn't want to win?
Yeah.
Right? What great athlete doesn't, at their core, want to win? This is another thing to go try and win. So I think he cares for sure.
And I should say, too, Zach's got a great piece about the whole Michael versus LeBron stuff. The whole, like, and you go deep, deep, deep on this. And can
I say something about that?
Yeah.
There's all this stuff now about how, like, oh, I don't even want to engage in that debate. It's so boring. And like we're above this. Like we're supposed to be above comparing Michael Jordan and LeBron. We just watched a 10-hour documentary about how great Michael Jordan. Like, oh, we're, as sports writers, we're just supposed to like not do that piece. Like, I don't know. When did that happen? I don't understand when that happened.
I understand the fatigue over it. And as somebody who is kind of agnostic on this myself and hates being put on the spot when other people ask me who is like. It's a fun discussion. It's great to analyze. And
That's it. It's right. A fun discussion.
Yeah. And your story did that. You're not saying definitively it's one way or the other. You're just saying here are all the things to consider that often get lost.
I am saying definitively, I think it's going to be LeBron. I just think the cumulative argument, unless you just can't get by 6-0.
Is or I will be.
Ooh, that's a good question, Howard Beck.
It's getting close right now.
Yeah, I think not to go to sidetrack because we could spend the rest of this entire podcast on this, but I do think that it's always going to be an impossible discussion on some level because 6-0 is like this impermeable like bulwark of an argument. Like you just throw this at 6-0 and then it's over, and it's not. It's not because LeBron's been.
That's where I am. It's right. You can't. He's reached the point where you can't just say
when you
that
go to now. 10 finals and 9 out of 10 and 3 different teams to championships and all these different casts around him and all the things he's done statistically and all the ways he affects.
He went to 10 finals. Say that out loud. Like keep saying
finals.
That out loud.
10 finals right? And 9 in 10 years. In the modern era of free agency, not to mention hyper free agency, of which he pioneered, of course. But teams don't stay together for more than about 2.5 seasons now. So it's even harder to have any continuity. So
I keep calling the NBA finals of this decade the LeBron James Invitational because that is literally save 1 year when he was hurt for a chunk of the season. Like that is literally what they have been, which is insane for a player in this era to dominate like that. Now, I will say, Zach, I am not a huge fan of MJ versus LeBron, but not because like we're all too holier than thou to have it. I just think at its core, there's a point where when athletes play in different periods of time and different eras with frankly like pretty different rules, it almost becomes a slightly different game.
Of course,
and that you have to basically just say, hey, there's 3 or 4 guys who were the best. And we all know who they are because we have eyeballs.
We go through this on MVP every year, right? Where like the criteria is all murky and like, is it valuable?
Yes, we do, Zach Lowe.
Which
is why Rachel wants a greatest player award.
But what's the criteria? And at some point, I just still think it's fun to make a choice. Like, I think at the end of the day, someone's got to be the best ever. And like, that doesn't necessarily mean you and I will agree on who it is. But everyone in their head is going to come to a conclusion of who they think is the best. And I will say, we are of the same age cohort, all three of us, although I am the youngest. I am
absolutely the oldest.
I am young.
I was
going to
say, I'm not the oldest.
But I understand why people can't get by 6-0 because we all lived it. Like,
yeah.
I actually would throw this to you guys. I'm going back with a Bulls fan who I very good friends with for 25 years now, or 20 years now on text. And he's saying it's interesting that I thought in real time, like I never thought the Bulls would lose. Once they won the first title, once they got by the Pistons, like down 2-0 against the Knicks in 93, never thought they would lose. Game 6 in Phoenix coming down to the wire, never thought they would lose. 2-2 finals against Portland, 92, never thought they would lose. He said as a Bulls fan, it didn't feel that way to me in real time, to him. To me, the Bulls just felt it, this. To me, the idea that Jordan was indomitable and inevitable is not something that happened in hindsight. I felt it watching in real time, and I'm curious to see if I'm just projecting that, or did you guys also feel that?
Well, Rach, you covered at least some of that, right? And I was that was before my NBA career. So
tiny guppy, yes, in a very scared way with a notebook in the corner of the locker room as a 19-year-old. My question on that, though, and sort of that into the framework of this larger discussion, LeBron James has unquestionably had some great teammates, right? Dwayne Wade, now Anthony Davis, Kyrie Irving. In those moments, I think that Cleveland team was exceptional that won the title, and the year before, if those guys hadn't gotten hurt. Did he have anyone of the equivalent of Scottie Pippen? Because if the answer is no, then you start getting into, okay, why were the Bulls inevitable? Was it 100% MJ?
No.
If it's less, what's the percentage? Like that, then you have to start looking at the nuance. If you get to the Bulls were inevitable as a big point of this discussion, I kind of need to get a little deeper into why and how much of that Michael's responsible for. And clearly it's the majority, but how much over 50%? Did he have, has LeBron had a teammate that was Scottie Pippen level?
Well, go back to even just the Bulls era, though. Did anybody else who was not, nobody's at Michael's level, did any of the other superstars in the league at that time have a second banana who was as great as Scottie Pippen? That's the other way to look at it, right? Like, who was the next best Scottie Pippen in the Jordan era?
Stockton Malone, probably.
Yeah.
As a big two.
Yeah.
So do you guys think Wade, Kyrie, or AD, because those were obviously LeBron's best teammates in the three stops that he's won titles now, do you think any of them are Scottie Pippen level?
I think AD will go down as that level and is probably there now in terms of a two-way force. Wade and LeBron are Scottie and Michael like in terms of their skill sets and how they complement each other and when they were really rolling, what they could do to teams on both ends of the floor. But Wade's health started to fail him after the first season together. I'm just talking purely from like a fan slash observer of the NBA. Like, I just never thought the Bulls would lose. We all knew the Byron Russell shot was going in. Like, you never, I have never felt that way about really LeBron taking a jump shot. Like, I never felt quite the certitude of it. Like, I remember I was sitting on the couch next to my dad. I was like, shot's going in. We all know it's going in. Like, yeah. You all knew Jordan was going to find a way to make a steal and a jump. You just knew. I can't explain it to people who weren't there. Maybe I'm just projecting, but we all knew. I thought we all knew.
It is a different phenomenon, but I'm not sure that in the totality of the 90s that it was a given that as long as Jordan was playing, they were always going to win the championship. I'm not sure if it was that certain.
It wasn't. I mean, the Pacers took them to seven. Like, yeah. They had moments of real vulnerability, but it just, I don't know. It never felt as in doubt as the score and the results suggested it should have felt.
Okay, so LeBron now has four rings. Each of those four are very, very different. He did the usual last night. It was almost like asking you to identify, which of your children is your favorite. He was not going to start ranking them, but we can. Where does this one rank?
I'm interested. I don't know what this one is yet, right? Is this the first of two or three where he won this one and then in 2 years they win another one, but it's AD who's the primary player in the MVP? Like, what is this? Is this the beginning of something? Is this the singular sort of last stab of LeBron's sort of, is this the last final peak that he climbed?
Okay,
if
he never wins another one, we don't need future context. The context is now. The context is he won this one in his second year with the Lakers. And he won one that got him on the board in Miami and another one to certify the first one. And he won the one that ended Cleveland's 5,037-year drought.
I mean, then I would still go. If this is one of one, the Lakers one, then I would still go with the Cleveland one. Just because coming back from 3-1 against a 73-win team is something that has literally never been done before. So, or since. So there you go.
I think it's the Cleveland one. The Cleveland one is the capstone of his, not the capstone because that implies it comes last. It's because it's Cleveland, because it was 73 wins, game seven on the road, the most iconic play of his career happens in that game. I think it's always going to be that one.
I said
what it meant too, yeah. Right? I mean, what it meant off the court, and we say like, oh, ended their, you know, million year drought or whatever, but it was more than that, right? I mean, we were all covering those teams. It was about a time and place. LeBron came back. He came back to a place that a lot of people had been leaving, right? When you look at manufacturing jobs, and people have written all kinds of great think pieces on the American Midwest and Ohio in particular, and all of the stuff going on sociologically there. The fact that LeBron left for a place that was glamorous and warm and sunny and everything Miami is, and then he came back on purpose. He wasn't drafted there that second time. He didn't have to. He came back for them. He came back for those people. And he won as a huge underdog, considering the 3-1 and the circumstance and the moment of those finals. And that represented something to the people there in a way that I know Lakers fans love their team. Howard, you covered this team day to day. They think there's an inevitability of them winning. But it's not going to mean the same to a Lakers fan as it did in Ohio, I think, in that moment and what it meant off the court for them, too.
And yet... So right before we taped this, I did a show, a finals wrap up with some of the crew at SiriusXM NBA Radio. And I suggested this, that if I'm ranking the top, his four finals, his four championships, I should say, that number one is actually his first one, because we have all forgotten now the burdens he was carrying, the backlash, the hatred, the doubts. He was, whatever, 8 years into his career at that point, and people are talking about he's this all-time great talent, but he's not even, you know, people don't even want to put him ahead of Kobe at that time, because Kobe's got all the rings and LeBron doesn't. Jordan discussion, forget about it entirely. He got swept by the Spurs his first time, couldn't get out, finally just had to leave Cleveland entirely and form a super team, has the whole world hating him, deriding him, doubting him. So the first one to me, I think, was just such a huge weight off. And if you think about the failure and how everybody was piling on in 2011, everybody in the world, except for Cavs, or except for Heat fans, I should say, and LeBron fans, everybody else in the world was rooting for the Dallas Mavericks and loved watching Dirk knock him off. So that first one that he wins in Miami, I think, is number one. And I'm actually putting this one number two ahead of Cleveland. And this is where
Explain yourself.
You're nuts.
No,
you might as well go out. You might as well end the full 48 by getting all your crazy. What else you got? What other crazy takes you want to get out to the ether?
Wings suck. Wings are a fraud perpetrated on society by the wing lobby.
I'm with you on that.
Thank you. Wings are a fraud. But we digress. That is my hottest take that I'm always afraid to put on Twitter, lest my mentions just become even more of a shit show than they usually already are. No, this one. Zach, bear with me on this. Rachel, like. Here's the thing. He goes to L.A. in what looks like this is the farewell tour. Remember, when he made the move and without any other stars, we all thought he was going with somebody. Paul George, somebody was going with him. Nobody went with him. And we thought, well, what's he going to do? Win championships with Lonzo Ball and Brandon Ingram and you know, Josh? Like, we didn't. Nobody thought there was any real path there at that exact moment. And then he gets hurt, and then they miss the playoffs, and he's 35, and people are writing him off. I did not. But it certainly, there was no certainty that he was going to be able to win there. And he took on all the pressures that come with joining this iconic franchise that is used to nothing but championships. And he could be the greatest Laker of all time in terms of where he'll finish as an NBA player. But he would certainly not be the greatest Laker of all time in Laker uniform, because Kobe and Magic occupy it. And then it's Kareem and Shaq and Jerry West. And so to get this one, and in the year that we lost Kobe Bryant, I hate playing on that, because that emotional thing that people keep bringing into it. I don't want to. They didn't win this for Kobe and Gigi, right? Like I find that almost like too much, but it's not insignificant in this whole mosaic of this season. What they accomplished, what LeBron accomplished with this team in a year of a pandemic, in the year of the bubble, in the year of George Floyd, in the year of losing Kobe Bryant, and because it's the Lakers. And because what it does to further secure his legacy, not just broadly historically, but also with that franchise, one of the most important franchises in the league, I think elevates this in a much different way. That's my case.
I don't hate it. I mean, look, when I had O'Shea Jackson Jr. on my podcast, you know, I talked to him about how I said something on Twitter about how, think of the calendar year the Lakers have had. And how impressive it is that they've made the finals. And I got all this pushback, like, well, everyone had a horrible calendar year. Everyone had a pandemic. the social justice protests and issues are roiling inside everybody in their own way. Everyone's dealing with the mental anxiety of that, of the bubble and all that stuff. And I said to myself, think a little harder about the Lakers calendar year, because there's a couple of things that differentiate it, a couple of big things that differentiate it from all that other stuff. And it's like Kobe, there's just no words for it. It's beyond words, but it even starts in China with, you know, they're on the plane there when Daryl Morey tweets his tweet, and they're at the center of a maelstrom for, 2 weeks. Once they get back, they're still at the center of it. I mean, all of that stuff is strain. It wears people down.
Yeah. And they endured, they persevered. So the kind of a question. Yeah, go ahead, Rach.
Well, I just want to say one thing about the Kobe thing before we move on. I hate when people treat that as a sort of a binary discussion, that it's either has to be all for Kobe or they're using Kobe and it's completely irrelevant. That it's not binary. That anybody who's felt loss in their life understands that A, it affects you. It is traumatizing and it is, as you say, a strain, and that it affects how you think and move going forward. And to pretend that the Lakers organization was not so deeply tied to Kobe Bryant, they wouldn't rattle the psyche of everyone involved, is crazy. And to pretend too that it's somehow not okay for those people who knew him, and I'm talking now about Jeannie Buss, who was as close to a star player as any team owner in the time that I've covered the league that I can remember. Rob Pelinka, who according to Kobe was his best friend, and the players who had their individual relationships with him. LeBron and Kobe obviously had a complicated rivalry, but they were teammates on the Olympics and they did respect each other. And Anthony Davis was very close to Kobe as sort of a big brother type person in the league and check in with him a lot. There were all sorts of ties throughout that organization and a sense of loss. And it is frustrating to see how reductive our culture and internet culture and all that stuff is, that everything's either horrible or fantastic. There's only extremes. But in this particular thing, it has been really bothering me the way people talk about this, that it either has to be completely one or the other, when of course anyone who has had someone that they love or even like die knows that it is not all everything.
Yeah. No, agreed.
This is my speech.
No, agreed. And well said. And I do think that, again, for all of that, LeBron has just kind of bound himself to this franchise in a way that he couldn't without winning the title. And doing it this year with everything they've been through just made it, I think, that much more meaningful. Is it too soon to have the discussion about now where LeBron is in the Laker pantheon? I mean, he does have more years to go. No, I mean, listen, like, if he never won a championship but was just LeBron James in a Laker jersey, he would never have any chance of being talked about in the same breath as Kobe and Magic, Jerry West, Kareem. If it's too soon, we'll just move on. But is it too soon to talk about where he now stands in Lakerdom?
To me, because of the way that LeBron has navigated his career, because of how he has taken control of it in a way that no superstar really before him ever did, I think he transcends those kind of team conceits like that. I just think his pantheon discussion is Jordan, Kareem, Russell, much more like the Lakers one. Is not even that interesting to me because he has, I transcend is a strong word, but it's not about that. It's not, I mean, it is for Laker fans and all that, but in terms of the totality of his career, I just don't think he fits in that kind of discussion box.
Fair. I think Laker fans do discuss it because for a long time it was Magic was the undisputed most beloved Laker. And then Kobe, for some people, supplanted him or is co-most beloved or something. And that was even before we lost Kobe. I just think it's interesting for maybe more for the LA.
Well, the most basic reality is he's just never going to play there long enough to accumulate the sort of, you know, whatever that those guys did.
How long is their window now? If the goal now is he's got four, can he get to six? Or the goal now is he's got four and let's see how much of a Laker legacy he can build in this, what we believe is the final chapter of his NBA career. What's the window now, Zach?
I was texting with someone today saying, you know, do you think LeBron could still be a top 20 player in 3 years? I said, top 20? He's one right now. Like, I would put the odds on that at like 90% that he's still a top 20 player.
At 38, almost 39.
Who's the 20th best player in the NBA right now?
the 20th best player in the NBA right
now? I don't know who. I don't know the answer. I'm just saying LeBron, three years from now.
He has to fall a long way. Yeah.
There could be a big injury. There could be something. He could just say, I'm done with this. I'm retiring. But as long as he and AD are playing at a high level, the window's open. So I think you just have to set the over-under at 3.5 years. And I don't think they're going to be the favorite in all those years. I'm not necessarily sure, though, that they enter next season as the favorite. At least the field is going to be monstrously crowded in both conferences. But as long as those two guys are playing at a high level, the window's open.
And look, I mean, one of the things I asked him last night is I said, hey, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar played in a Laker uniform at age 40. Like, do you see that for yourself? And Howard, you have all of the encyclopedic Lakers history. What was the oldest Kareem was when he won a title? Was he 40?
I think I'm not that encyclopedic. I think he might have had his last at 38, but I'm not positive of that. I'd have to look it up.
So I'll look just it up as a model.
Yeah.
Just as a model, right? And especially since we know, and you know, AD, I loved playing, loved seeing him play coy. I don't know what I'm going to do as a free agent this offseason. I mean, what is the point of playing coy? I mean, isn't there a max amount of money they can offer him? Aren't they going to offer him that max amount? Isn't he going to take it? Like, what is he bargaining for at this point? Anyway, in theory, he's a free agent, but we know that he will be there for the next however many years. With a player that we all agree is a superstar in Anthony Davis, who is really in the middle of his prime or entering his prime even, and whatever pieces they may or may not add over the next few years, because with a depressed salary cap, there's going to be more guys out there who just say, if I'm not earning crazy money anyway, I want to go play with LeBron James and Anthony Davis in LA and play for the Lakers. Like, they could get a pretty good team around them through LeBron turning 38, 39, 40 Kareem Abdul-Jabbar looking thing, right?
And he was 40, by the way. You were right. Kareem was 40 for his last title.
Right? So LeBron's 35 right now, near 36, but he's 35 right now. I mean, what do you guys think? Do you think that scenario could unfold over the next 5 years? Even if they don't win next year, could they win one or two more in the next five, depending on how they build the team?
Sure. I don't see why not. I mean, two is hard because it's just hard to win.
Right.
You know.
But do we think less of Kareem because one of his rings came when he was 40 and he was not Kareem?
He was an all-star.
I know, but that's but your point that LeBron would fall pretty far. You know what I mean? Like, I can see LeBron being that guy.
Well, the great thing about, you know, AD is, you know, we're going to talk on the jump today about, you know, is next season the year where the keys get turned over to AD? And my answer, spoiler alert, is going to be no, because I think of the keys metaphor as who's driving the car, who's running the offense, who is organizing you when the chips are down. That's always going to be LeBron on offense. But the great thing about having a co-star like AD is LeBron, if age starts to take more of a toll, whatever it is, can play that role and become like a, I'm just making this up completely off the top of my head, like a 22-10-8 guy, just like the scoring drops down, but he's still in control of the game completely, and AD becomes a 31 whatever, you know what I mean? Like, I think that's the beautiful thing about their partnership.
How differently do we see AD now? I mean, we knew he was being talked about as a top five player for I don't know how many years running before this, but then it started to become with the caveats behind it, right? Because of the lack of success in New Orleans. Do we see him significantly differently today?
I've been having this conversation with Anthony through the entire playoffs. It's so interesting. I think this is fascinating, this idea that he has told me for years, like really for the last 3 or 4 years, as I've gone to New Orleans and done sit downs in Chicago and whatever, he's like, I just want to test myself. I want to know how good I am. And he said that to me over and over so often that I knew, frankly, that he was leaving before he was leaving. And I was so happy for him that he got to do that here. And what he found out about himself and what we all found out was not only did we think he was going to be this good, but he actually is this good. And he now has the beginning of the body of work to prove it. And that bigger idea in sports, and like Jimmy Butler has a version of it this postseason also, of the top 10% of players of all time are going to be great no matter what. The bottom 10% of players are going to be terrible no matter what, right? But the middle 80% is fit in the moment. And where are you? And can you do the thing? And when we get to see an athlete cycle out of a fit that wasn't a place where he could be his best self into a place where he or she can be their best self, is so cool as a sports fan. I'm fascinated by this as an idea. And the fact that we got to see it with two different players this postseason was really awesome.
AD reminds me of Pippen in this sense. Like, is he a top 3, 4, 5 player, whatever? We still, like, we don't know the answer to, could he be the number one off? Could he be the guy with the keys on a championship team, right? Like, and Scotty, the answer was probably not, maybe not. We don't know because we never saw it. But this is like the vagaries of team building. Like, there may have been other guys in the NBA when Scotty played, and there are other guys in the NBA right now with Anthony Davis who are quote unquote better at being the number one option of a good NBA offense than him, but not as powerful in pursuing championships because of how good a number two guy AD and Pippen were. You know what I mean? Like, you can be, if you're the best number two guy in terms of just your role on offense, just your role in shot creation for other teammates, if you're the best number two guy because of your fit, your defense, your finishing, whatever it is, you can be, to me, if you're trying to pursue a championship, better than someone who's maybe a superior number one guy to you, just in the purest sense of who's driving the offense. And that's where AD is to me, because you're going to hear the, you know, what happens if LeBron gets hurt. We've never seen AD lead a team, blah, blah, blah. And that's all true and fair, but he's so fantastic at everything that he does that he elevates himself to a high stature.
I agree with all of that. And I also think that, you know, we can look at guys and start picking them apart. Like, you know, we can do the, you know, would Scottie Pippen have been as great without Michael and all that stuff? And it's like, we already know the answer is that, like, all of these guys, including the alpha dogs, all needed their other all-stars, whether those guys were suited to be alpha dogs themselves or not, blah, blah, blah. Like, everybody, all-stars need other all-stars to win championships. Superstars need other all-stars. And maybe AD needed a LeBron, and maybe eventually AD won't need LeBron, or maybe AD will be able to lead them to titles with a different LeBron who's starting to step back a little bit more due to age and maybe handle the ball less. We'll see. Like, that's, there's still many years of Anthony Davis to go for him to prove his greatness and to evolve.
27.
Yeah, so much time left. I was curious about this too, though, because, right, LeBron, we talk about it, it's always a legacy thing, but the other thing that struck me over the course of the finals, and maybe the bubble entirely, but the final, is like, I think some images just got changed different, just overall. So LeBron's legacy argument aside, who burnished their image the most the last few weeks, and why is it Jimmy Butler?
Rach, you want to take that one, or you want me to go first?
Well, I'm the wrong person to ask about Jimmy, since you know that I've been a Jimmy Butler enthusiast of watching the way he plays and goes about his business for a long time.
And I'm with you.
You know, I I've been on record for a long time and criticized for that for a long time. So I'm excited to see everyone else come around my parade float. I would actually say, because I've felt that way about Jimmy for a long time, since frankly he was in Chicago, Rajon Rondo, I think, is an underplayed story because we've got so many of them. He told me he almost retired a few years ago because when the catastrophe in Dallas happened between him and Rick Carlisle, and everyone, we can assign all kinds of blame for that. He said that only two teams called him that offseason, and that he was sort of thinking, well, I just don't want to do this anymore. He could have been out of basketball. Dwight Howard certainly appeared to be out of basketball. And if not for the injury to DeMarcus Cousins, probably would have been, right? So here are two guys who I think would have gone down a certain way. Obviously Rondo differently since he was a champion and on two NBA finals teams, but still sort of the way we thought of him and the way he would have left the league. And Dwight certainly, who now are totally different. Their stories end and are totally different, and they have these redemption arcs and all the stories we like to tell and use athletes to demonstrate. So I think those are two really interesting stories, and I just am very happy the rest of the world sees the Jimmy Butler on the court that I have seen for the last however many years.
Well, I think the Jimmy thing is interesting because I still think, even if you were bullish on, not bullish, but even if you were at the top 1% of what Jimmy Butler was in the NBA, I don't necessarily think 40-point triple-doubles and 35-point triple-doubles going toe-to-toe with LeBron was really something that even those people thought he had in him. Because even his fans within the league, and I would count myself as one of them, but I'm talking about team employees, you would hear all the time, Jimmy Butler's a great player. 9th best player in the NBA, 11th best player in the NBA. And this is, I'm parroting what I've heard from team executives. probably not good enough to be the number one option on a championship team.
That's why the Bulls moved him, right?
Well, exactly. And then you would start to say, you would start to hear. And then the trouble with Jimmy is, you know, because of his shooting, he's not quite like a snug fit as the number two guy on a championship team. Like Paul George, well, that's obvious. That's a snug fit as a number two guy on a championship team. He can catch and shoot, comes off screens, plays incredible defense. And I think Jimmy tossed that narrative on its head with his performance in the playoffs and specifically in the finals. Like, yeah, they didn't win, but they came within two wins of an NBA title. I think if you get that close, I don't care what the circumstances are. I think if you get that close, the answer of can you be the number one option on a championship team is pretty damn close to yes.
No,
but
no
here's
question.
Where I would disagree slightly, though, in that is that I don't think like, and again, you're again coming from me who has been a Jimmy Butler town crier on his worth and value for a team. I don't think he could be the number one option on any championship team. I think the thing that he has beat the drum on through this whole postseason and the Heat have beat the drum on what's their saying? You know, we're not for everyone. Jimmy's like, I'm not for everyone. The Heat are like, we're not for everyone. That is certainly true, right? We've seen players just not cut it there in Miami. I really think that the way of looking at Jimmy Butler in this sort of global way is, could he do this for any team? Is the wrong way of looking at Jimmy Butler.
But that's my point, though. It depends a lot on roster construction and coaching and the talent around you and having a Bam Adebayo and having a Goran Dragic and having this sort of team where everyone is doing something at a pretty high level. It's just all of those questions we tend to, as you talked about Twitter before, we tend to boil them down to pretty binary black and white questions. You either are that stature or you're not. And Jimmy is not that stature in the as classic a way as LeBron or even like a Luka Doncic is going to be, someone who profiles like that. But on this team, with this supporting cast, you get within two wins of a title. You've answered the question.
And I'm not going to,
Well, I was just going to say, so to me then that begs that maybe we're looking at the wrong paradigm sometime when we have this conversation.
I think that's fair.
We're missing the boat when we try to have it as a global conversation. Is this guy good enough to do this on any team in any circumstance? That's not the question, really, because if you are building a team, you're not any team, you're your team. And so the question is, can we weaponize this guy who has all of these positives and attributes in the best way? And if we can do that, and that's what the Heat did with Jimmy Butler, we can turn him into his most powerful self, or he can be his most powerful self.
Meanwhile,
and how good is that most powerful self? That's how we should be looking at all of these guys. It's not just globally, could they do this anywhere on any team? Because when you go to an NBA Finals and you fight for a championship, you're not any team, you're your team. And that's, to me, how I think the good teams know how to look at players that way and build around them.
Meanwhile, the Heat have max salary cap space for the summer of 2021. Just looming.
Just a little side note there.
Yes, they do.
Looming.
Little side note there. No, to Rachel's point, LeBron James is the one player in the NBA, maybe in our, and you know, certainly in this era, and one of the only in our lifetimes, who you could move him around the league and they immediately become contenders just because he's LeBron. Almost everybody else, probably everybody else, at least in this era, it's contextual. I would argue, just as a quick point, that and I'm not going to take us down this rabbit hole. I just want to post it there to the side just so people know it's there. I think this Jimmy could have made the Sixers a contender if they had kept him.
No question.
So,
of course.
So
yes.
It's not just that it was Miami and Heat culture, although all due credit to them
and the team
they assembled. But yes, Jimmy in certain places, Philly was one of them. Minnesota was not.
First of all, it's hashtag Heat culture. Second of all, the other guy that I think you could for sure move, I think there's another guy who next year is a big year for this guy, who I think, yes, you probably can move him almost anywhere and become a 50-win team, is Kevin Durant.
Say Kevin Durant. I knew it.
And next year.
I was like, wait, we're forgetting about Kevin Durant, guys.
And Kawhi's close.
Kawhi's close. Yes.
If not there. But I'll next year, when you start thinking about next season, it's too early and we're all hungover from the bubble. Brooklyn at full health. Warriors.
Okay,
back.
So that's my Kevin Durant question,
loaded.
Though.
It's loaded next year.
Do you guys think Kevin Durant is going to be Kevin Durant this season, this coming season, whenever that starts, whenever we have a next season? Do you think Kevin Durant is going to be the Kevin Durant we last saw before he got hurt?
My short perfunctory answer is that I hope he is, but all history and science tells us that he won't be 100%. If he's 95 or 90 or whatever, they might still be fine. But I just think, we were going to be too quick to anoint the Nets as a contender. They should be, and on paper they are. But as we saw with the Clippers this season, sometimes on paper can burn you. And Kyrie and KD have never actually played together. Kyrie's got his own injury issues or injury history. KD will be still great, but maybe not as great as he was pre-Achilles. And also, he's just older. Steve Nash, we all love and respect, but he's never coached before. Like, the Nets have plenty of caveats, but between them and Toronto and Milwaukee and Miami, like the East is going to be really freaking interesting next year. Like, that's a given. We've got like 6 or so minutes left before you guys have to run off and do TV things in your glamorous TV life. What's one bubble thing that we saw that we want to continue into next year when we hopefully are not watching the NBA in a bubble? Whatever next season takes on, whatever it looks like, what's one bubble thing, one feature or revelation, innovation that we want to see continue?
Play-in tournament. It's a no-brainer.
That's a no-brainer. Yeah.
It's a no-brainer. Just make the play-in tournament a thing.
It's a no-brainer to all of us, but it's funny. When Adam Silver's been asked about it, he's hedged. Have you guys noticed that? Because I don't think he's got full ownership support on it.
Because he's been going at this for whatever, 7 years that he's been in the chair now, 6 years, whatever it's been. Like, mm-hmm. He's been trying. Like, this is one of those things that he just has not been able to break through on. And yeah, if you don't get the support. But this should push them all in that direction. It absolutely should. The other one I was going to throw out there was referees having a courtside microphone that helps explain to the viewing audience what
absolutely
just happened. That is automatic.
That's happening. I've heard them say that's here to stay.
It's so great. Because occasionally they would say to the courtside, if the announcers are even courtside, they might say, hey, here's what we're doing. And then they translate it for the viewer. Actually hearing Zach Zarba or Mark Davis or whatever explain what they're about to do or what they just figured out by the replay. No brainer. Like, it's one of those things where you think they should have done this years ago.
I'm trying to think if there's another bubble thing that I would like to carry over.
I jotted a couple things down. Like, there's more floor space for them to chase loose balls, but you know, the courtside seats have to come back, and the photographers have to come back, and you know,
I like courtside seats.
I was wondering,
I like the fans there.
Could we somehow incorporate virtual fans into packed arenas? Like, can we somehow add them to the actual fans? Like, and with, I don't know if it actually serves any purpose, but it's weird, but I don't know. I just thought, can we continue that somehow? Can we give people who can't afford a ticket to the game another way of quote unquote attending?
I like that idea.
Yeah.
I like that idea. That's cool. I like that. And that reasoning is good. I don't know. I don't think there's a way to shift the travel dynamic in terms of giving guys more time between games or anything like that. But it's inarguable that not switching time zones every 2 days and traveling back and forth and 6-hour flights gave us better basketball, right? I mean, we got the level of playoff basketball was fantastic. And it has to be because of people's bodies, not just not being killed. I mean, we all live it when we travel with them. And the time zone shift is real, man. Like, you're getting in at 3 a.m. and that's 6 a.m. your body time. And then these guys are practicing the next day. I don't know if there's a way to fix that but still have home arenas, which obviously we all want. But if it's just spacing out the games more or what?
And we all understand that NBA players travel in a much different way than regular people. And it's not just the private jets. It's that you get picked up right on the tarmac and all that. Like, you don't have to go through. There's just a lot of logistics that they don't have to go through that regular people spend time thinking about. It's the time zone change is like, if you travel across the country a lot, you know that how screwed up your body feels like all the time. Like, when I go to LA to do your show, God, I really hope I get to do that before 2025. Like, I'm screwed up the whole time I'm there. And I'm screwed up for the first 5 days I'm back. And I don't have to play against, like, Jimmy Butler trying to eat me alive. Like I don't have to do those things. I just got to walk around and get on television and, like, talk to people. The other thing, they'll never do it because of TV ratings. But, God, do I love a nice matinee game. God, do I love a nice matinee.
Well, they could do it on the weekends at least, and they don't even do that.
They do it on the weekends in the regular season sometimes. Right. I love a nice afternoon.
Back in the day when the NBA was on NBC, we had those, like, noon starts on Sundays, those afternoon games, afternoon playoff games. It was nice. I don't know why we have to start 9 o'clock at night in the Eastern time zone. Last question before we wrap this is, I know this is such a pointless exercise. Predict opening night of the 2021 season and how many games and what does it look like?
I'll go first.
I keep doing reporting on this. Go first.
I'll take it first. I'll predict Martin Luther King Day and as close to 82 as they can possibly get. What it looks like.
Fans?
I will say no bubbles. This is just a prediction, okay? No one could. God, we're in a pandemic where things change every day.
We're guessing.
Nobody take this as like I'm really confident about this. Not guessing, but not confident. Yeah. No bubbles. Teams playing in their home arenas. Level of fans varies by market and is completely dependent on rapid testing in any market. So like if there's no good rapid testing, probably not fans. If there is, I think it'll vary by market and what the virus is doing in each market. And a schedule which is both flexible in terms of its ability to pivot if there's a horrible outbreak somewhere and lighter on travel such that even if they have to skew it, so teams play their division much more frequently than they do now, or you play all your New York, East Coast games in one fell swoop. So, but that would be my guess, my educated guess.
So I think Martin Luther King Day is most likely. I keep hearing, and again, not reporting, just, you know, the conversations people have around the, you know, whatever we have here in the bubble, a steel drum table. There's a little bit of a pushback of, well, do we really want to give up Christmas? I've definitely heard people bandying that about. Do we really want to give up Christmas? Would we have to give up Christmas? If you do want to get 82 games in because of the revenue, if you give up Christmas and you go to Martin Luther King Day, what are you pushing against on the back end? I've heard them say over, owners say over and over, and Adam Silver certainly say over and over, we want to have fans in the stands, which I get. I understand that a lot of the ownership models, the revenue models are built on having fans and ticket sales. I know why you want fans in the stands. I want a pony. It doesn't mean I'm going to get it.
Why do people want ponies?
My daughter wants a pony, but she actually rides horses.
You clean up all their poop and they live in your yard. It sounds terrible to have a pony.
So I understand why the league, which has 30 extremely rich and powerful owners that are used to getting their way and used to people when someone's saying you can't do that, they then fire that person and rehire someone else who will say, yes, I can fix that for you. that if you are wrangling that ownership group, you are trying to pursue what they want, which is fans in the stands. But I do think you're right, Zach. Rapid testing is the thing they're depending on, because no matter what happens with the vaccine, it's not going to spread throughout the country at a rate that it could be ready for the beginning of next season. And obviously every governor, as we've seen, has very different ideas about what we should be doing during this virus. And there is a point, and this is the question I keep asking Adam Silver on television, which weirdly he just doesn't answer me on, is what's the drop dead date on the other end? I'm less interested in when we might start to when we have to start.
Yeah.
I want to know, and they've got it and they're not saying it. And I understand why they're not saying it. It's probably smart of them not to say it, but there's got to be a drop dead date on the other end. They can't start in June. You can't go 8 months without an NBA seat. You can't have an 8 month off season. So what is it? What is the drop dead date? I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's February. I don't know if it's March. You're going to run into the Olympics. You're going to run into the next season. You're going to have such a big off season that the eight teams that weren't in the bubble wouldn't have played for a year and a half. I mean, there's got to be a drop dead date. And I just don't know what it is.
Well, yeah. That's why the March rumors I've always been skeptical of March. You know, we've all heard these rumblings. Oh, they might wait till March because they want fans. I just feel like you run the risk of waiting for something that is not going to be feasible. And you get to December, you're like, you know what? I don't think it's going to happen in March. Like, we got to start. And I just think if you wait and wait and wait and wait for the, it's like perfect is the enemy of good, right? Like, if you keep waiting and waiting, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. I agree. MLK Day, if for all kinds of reasons, feels like when they would love to start and when I think it will start, if I had to make a flimsy prediction. Agree, they will do everything possible to get at least some percentage of fans in the stands at some point, but maybe not to start. And agree, they'll try to get 82 or as close to it as they can without necessarily screwing up next season, because eventually I do think they want to get back on track. I don't think they want a permanently shifted schedule. But we'll see. Maybe by the time I have another podcast to record, we'll have answers to all these questions. Who knows? Because it could be a while.
Take a minute to applaud.
Thank you.
The full 48, the job you have done, the listening you have given all of us, elevated discussions over and over again, great guests, smart conversations, different ways to look at things, you know, in a time where it is so binary and yes and no, you're always bringing nuance. And it's one of the reasons this is one of my favorite favorite things to come do is talk to you guys. And I'm grateful for all the stuff that you've put out there for the rest of us.
You really left it all on the floor for the full 48. You gave it all for 48, the full 48, you left it out on the floor. It's always been an honor to come on. I've always liked coming on. I like it when we do it better in your studios and all that. But thanks for allowing us to yap on the finale.
And we had to do it sober this time. So the next time when I have a new podcast somewhere else, we will resume Drunk with Power at maybe like, yes. Maybe we won't be taping in the middle of the day.
More importantly, if we ever get to do that in Vegas again.
Yes.
I'm going nuts. I'm leaving it all on the table. I'm going nuts.
I can't wait for that. Well, thank you both, Rach, Zach, both of you. Thank you for your generosity with your time today and in the past. I can tell you because I can see the numbers, like, people love when you come on this podcast. They love hearing you guys. They seem to love the three of us together talking nonsense. So drunk, sober, or otherwise. So that's been a joy. But an honor and a pleasure to have you guys on this last episode. Thank you for making the time, especially Rach, squeezing this in between seriously amazing duties last night, the honor of presenting the trophy and then a show to tape today. Zach still has to get dressed for that show, I think. I don't think he's wearing a Washington General shirt on the jump, but hey, be a nice
we'll
new look.
See, I myself have worn a Washington General shirt on the jump and a 6-hour plane ride at the end of the day, which I'm excited for. I will be That's going so home.
I'm happy for you to get to go home and go see your beautiful children and your beautiful girls. Guys, thank you again. Listeners, thank you again. And go to howardbeck.com where you can sign up, send me your email address, and I will email you as soon as I know where my new podcast will be and what it will be called and all that stuff. At Howard Beck on Twitter, howardbeck.com. Zach, Rach, you guys are the best. Thank you.
Thank you.